This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Local TV journalist and documentarian Steve Crump is back today with a series of four programs examining critical moments in the civil rights movement that took place in 1963. Those programs are airing this month on WTVI PBS Charlotte, and Steve will join us later in the hour to talk about his work. First, another TV journalist who began a unique series on race during her time at CNN. That series, by the way, continues, even though she has moved on to other things. Soledad O'Brien is responsible for that network's Black in America series, which was intended to be a conversation starter about race in this country. Even though she's moved on to work for Al Jazeera, her company Starfish Media Group continues to produce Black in America for CNN, and she's also been bringing the conversation in person to cities around the nation. Tonight, Charlotte becomes one of those cities. Soledad O'Brien's Black in America Town Hall is tonight at 7 at Knight Theater, and we have information about that on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks. More importantly, Soledad O'Brien joins us now. Welcome to the program.
And thank you so much. Appreciate that.
Nice to have you with us. I understand that one of the reasons you started this conversation on race is because you have been asked so many times about your own heritage. I mean, you have an interesting name, Soledad O'Brien.
Questions Maria like, de la Soledad Teresa Marchetti O'Brien. Soledad O'Brien would just be straightforward. Yeah, you know, my mom is Afro-Cuban. She came to this country in the late 1950s. My dad is Australian, and his parents were from Ireland, and he came to the United States in the late 1950s as well. And they dated and got married as an interracial couple, which was illegal at that time in the state where they lived, which was Maryland. And so I think that that has framed for me a lot of the conversations that I've been interested in around race, certainly. And really, I think just historically how the United States has changed and moved and gone through some very difficult times around the issues of race. So I've always had a personal interest in it, but we really started the documentary series. Started shooting it in 2007, but in 2008 when it aired, it was such an interesting time in the country. There was the first Black president was on his way to being elected, and it was the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King. And so that was really the impetus to take a look at, you know, where are we now, 40 years after the assassination? Where is that dream?
Yeah.
And then to explore really what America had become and where America was going,
you know,
through that prism.
Having worked in television and with a lot of women in television, women have to put up with a lot of things that men don't have to. Viewers asking them, you know, who does your hair? Why did you wear that makeup? That dress doesn't look good on you. Men are never told those things on television. And people would come up to you and say, what are you? Who are you? Did you find that?
I think actually happens to any light-skinned, brownish person. But what are you? And if you're feeling like you just want to screw around with them, you say, I'm an American. What are you? And then, of course, they're really asking about your racial mix. You know, some days it would really make me angry.
Mm-hmm.
It was annoying. And then other days I sort of felt more like, wow, this is a person who's truly trying to understand and wants to learn. And actually, I think as I became more involved in doing these kinds of stories, instead of getting annoyed, I tried to ask people why they were asking and really just turn to the question, which I think is such a powerful tool when you're a journalist to always ask people, well, what do you think?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you asking? Why is that interesting? And 99 times out of 100, you get a really, really interesting backstory.
And I read that when you first launched this series, some people asked, well, who are you to be having this conversation? And I thought about that question after I read it, and I thought, you know, we all live in the same country. We all have different racial backgrounds. We have to deal with each other's races. Why aren't we all qualified to have this conversation?
Yeah, you know, it's such an interesting question. And the funny thing for me was that I was getting both sides of that. Both. I was exactly the right person as a woman whose mother is Black and father is white to be able to tell this story. Or I was exactly the wrong person. And so, actually, at the time, I didn't take it very seriously because it was so contradictory because it was all happening at the same time. But I did ask people, you know, at the time, you know, Christiane Amanpour was doing a lot of reporting in China. And I would say, well, you know, so should she not be doing stories? And I mean, she's not Chinese, certainly. Does she not have a valid ability as a great journalist to tell those stories? Of course we don't say that. But I think it sort of underscores the way in which we're just really picky and sensitive about race. And that there is this idea that, you know, where are you coming from in this conversation? Because mm-hmm. that's going to really shape whether or not I can trust you in being a messenger of this conversation.
You've said that it's really about what side are you on? What perspective do you bring to this conversation? And I think that's interesting because I guess we have to be very careful about how we pose these questions because, or how we have these conversations, because there's no point in having a conversation if you put off the other person so they stop listening.
Yeah, you know, I always felt that as much as I was not, did not love growing up as a, Black Latina kid in the North Shore of Long Island, which is very white and very suburban, it was not fun at times. As a journalist, I have found that to be such a blessing. To sort of be an insider and an outsider in various communities is really helpful when you're asking people questions because they both know you're of the story. You know what you're talking about. You know experiences, but you're also not. So you can push people hard and really try to understand as an outsider. So as I got older, I found that to be a huge luxury. At the time, when I was a teenager, I found it to be really terrible to constantly feel like an outsider in your own home, where you really feel like you're an insider until someone makes it very clear that you're an outsider. That was always very challenging.
You know, one of the things that you cut your eye teeth on, made your name on, is asking very difficult, very, I don't want to say terse, but very important, very difficult questions to people on your TV show on CNN in the morning. And it didn't always go down well with people. When you have these conversations about race, can you approach it in that same way? Can you push people to give you an answer as opposed to tap dancing around the answer? And if you do that, do you get to the crux of the issue, or do you put people off?
Yeah, no, I think so. I think what we really did in the morning show and Starting Point was to have very fact-based interviews. So we had tons of research, and so a lot of our interviews were based on, you have said this, or the numbers show this, or why do you believe this specific thing? Now, sometimes that was interpreted as, oh, you're being harsh, or you're being tough, or you're challenging that person, but really I always felt like I just have a series of facts that we have researched in front of us. And so I think the same thing in interviewing people about race, when you talk to people about their personal subjective experience, I think you just listen. That's their personal opinion. But there are times when you have to push people. I did a great interview with a guy named Joe Miller for a documentary. I was a Latino in America doc. And he had very much said that he did not like Latino immigrants who were coming into his community, which was Shenandoah, Pennsylvania. And he was very much the guy leading the charge against these immigrants in his community. And in Shenandoah, there had been a killing, a murder of a young man, Mexican descent, who had been killed and beaten and stomped to death, basically, by a bunch of young white teenagers. And so the cover-up that ensued, et cetera, was the subject of our documentary. And I interviewed this guy, Joe Miller. In the morning, he was hanging up the American flag, the Marine Corps flag, because he served as a Marine, and the Confederate flag, hanging it from his porch. And then I interviewed him, and I asked him, well, why are you so vehemently against immigrants? And he said, because they steal jobs. I said, well, did you lose a job? What job did you lose? He said, oh, no, not me. I never lost a job. I said, oh, well, you must have a close friend who lost a job that you're so angry. Tell me about your friend. He said, oh, no, I don't have a friend who lost a job. And I said, well, so tell me then about, who's having their job stolen by the immigrants here in Shenandoah? And he said, the blacks. The blacks are having their job stolen. For a man who earlier in the morning was hanging up the Confederate flag, had, by 2 hours later, become a spokesperson for black people in Shenandoah, which I found incredibly amusing. But I think, when that documentary aired, he called me up and said he liked that. He felt that he was accurately represented in his views. Hmm. And ultimately, for me, that's what it's about, to make sure you get people's stories right. It's not whether I agree with them or I disagree with them. It's, are they accurately representing and telling the story about some very complicated issue that's unfolding here in America?
You identify, I read this, I'm not sure this is true, so you can confirm it. You identify as black, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Correct. Well, when I was growing up, there were no sort of options other than black and white. It's only today that you really have, I'm biracial. I grew up in an all-white community, and I don't think anyone, we certainly were not white. That was made very clear to us in a number of instances.
Your father was.
Right, but I think that if you look historically at the one drop rule, which is, how people were sort of identified, there was a sense, and my parents would have both said to me when I was a kid, my dad who's white and my mom who's black, you're black. You are black. If your mother's black, you're black. Half black is black. you're black. Now, technically, you're racially mixed, but, you know, you are, for purposes of America, you are a light-skinned black girl. And so that was that was my identity, and an identity that I was happy with, and living in a community where you clearly were not white. There was no, hey, I'm white in my community at all.
Well, let's bring that into the conversation, because we have an African American person who identifies as being black, and yet his mother was white. You have a father who was white and a mother who was Latina and also black, and you identify as black. And the one drop rule stems from Jim Crow.
Even before that, the one drop rule really stems from slavery, right?
So,
the idea that you could increase your slaves if those were your own children.
So,
I get that it doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of how, you know, should we be relying on how people are identified in slave times. But I do think that if you look at the president of the United States, he's black. That's what he looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, it was certainly helpful that my parents said when I was very young, I remember as the youngest, probably 6 or 7, you know, don't let anyone tell you you're not black, and don't let anyone tell you you're not Latino. And I remember thinking, we live in an all-white neighborhood, like, what are they talking about?
And yet,
people are crazy.
And yet you don't speak Spanish.
I speak Spanglish. And my children actually speak much better Spanish than I do. My mom was very adamant in this community where we live that we did not speak Spanish. I think she was always trying to figure out, you know, how do you
fit in,
blend in, kind of keep your head down, and just get through, you know, why we moved here, which was for good schools. My dad was a professor at SUNY Stony Brook.
Mm-hmm.
This is where his job is. This is what we do. Keep your head down. Utilize this area for good schools, and then you can go wherever you want.
So,
and I think that that was their strategy. But, again, I think that the idea that people who were mixed race sort of had this choice when I was growing up, you know, 47 years ago, just isn't really... It did not exist. It wasn't really the case.
Soledad O'Brien is our guest. You launched this multi-city speaking tour this month to continue the conversation on race, and it's tonight at 7 at the Knight Theater, and folks are invited to that. As I said, we have information about that on our website. Charlotte has got to be, since this is early in February still, one of the first stops on the tour. How will this conversation be different from the one you started on television?
Oh, gosh, you know, I think any time that you can open up a conversation to people's personal experiences, that's a great opportunity. That was really kind of the goal, that in a way documentary takes you so far and yet not far enough because you don't get to hear back from the audience. So we'll include some local folks talking today on our panel to really flesh out the issues that are of importance to them in the community. And we'll also open it up to the audience because we want to hear what they're thinking. In addition, you see, had these really high-profile events that have happened, not just Trayvon Martin, but certainly the Jordan Davis shooting and killing and the verdict that has come down. And I think it has a lot of people trying to figure out, you know, what's happening in America today, that a case like that would now certainly Michael Dunn's going to go off to prison. We know that. But, you know, the fact that he would not be convicted in murdering that child, I think is confusing to a lot of people, and it's something we want to talk about.
We have to take a break. Soledad O'Brien is our guest. She'll be here tonight at the Knight Theater at 7 o'clock on behalf of the Harvey B. Gantt Center for African American Arts and Culture for her Black in America Town Hall meeting, and we'll continue our conversation about race in America and about what she plans to have happen tonight at that town hall meeting when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Children's Theater of Charlotte, presenting Petite Rouge, a Cajun Red Riding Hood, a musical in the style of last season's Pinkalicious, Friday through March 9th, details at ctcharlotte.org. And Diamonds Direct South Park, offering certified diamonds from their own diamond cutters in Tel Aviv, including rare colored diamonds and fancy cut diamonds from 1 carat to 10 carats. Sharon Road across from South Park Mall, diamonds-direct.com. Coal ash has been in the news a lot of late, and that's because it's in the water of the Dan River, thanks to a leaky pipe that allowed millions of gallons from a Duke Energy coal ash pond to leak out. Coal ash, by the way, is neither regulated nor classified as a hazardous material, but it contains things like arsenic, cadmium, and chromium. So, now what? and who pays for the cleanup, and where do we go from here? We talk about all that tomorrow at 9.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, a white Florida man was convicted of attempted murder for firing a gun at four African-American teenagers playing loud music. Controversy over the jury's verdict and stand your ground laws across the country.
Join the conversation on the Ian Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today to Soledad O'Brien from CNN, Al Jazeera, MSNBC, HBO's Real Sports with Bryant Gumbel, which really surprises me.
What?
Well, I don't know. It just surprises me. I didn't think that was an area of expertise for you, but that's okay.
Well, you know what's so interesting on that? Real Sports is not really about sports, and Bryant himself says this all the time, no more than, you know, Rocky is a movie about boxing, right? Anybody who says, well, the Rocky series was really a movie about boxing is completely wrong. It's not. It's about redemption. It's about wanting something. It's about dreaming and goals and working hard. It's yes, and boxing is in it, but it's not about boxing. But so for me, Real Sports is really the same thing.
It's why most of us are watching the Olympics, because most of us don't know a darn thing about bobsledding, but it's the story behind the bobsled.
Always.
Yeah. Soledad O'Brien is coming tonight at 7 o'clock to be at the Knight Theater to conduct a conversation on race, black in America, her town hall meetings. When President Obama was elected, many people hoped that he would begin a conversation on race, because who better to do that than our first African-American president? But so far, he really hasn't done so. Should he have?
You know, I think the speech that he gave about race before he came into office was a great speech. I think it's just a minefield, and as an elected official at any level, but certainly at the highest level, whenever you open your mouth on something, you spend some political capital. And so I think it's been tricky when he talked about, you know, Trayvon Martin could have been my son. That was a speech about race to some degree. And in some ways it distracted from the conversation because the president had weighed in, and then it became political and messy. I think he's going to have more opportunities when it's not connected to his political office. And he can, just in the same way that I think, and you've certainly seen it with President Clinton, you know, that they can now sort of take positions.
Yeah, they're freer.
Yeah, and they doesn't distract from, well, I'm trying to get this legislation through, or I need to rally people around this vote, and it becomes polarizing and challenging. So my guess would be that we're going to see that more when he's not in office.
When you've had these conversations about race, either for the interviews you've done for the TV series, which continues on CNN, or for these town hall meetings, who's more reluctant or more comfortable to talk about it, blacks or whites?
You know, actually, I think everybody's fine if they feel like they're not going to be pummeled in the conversation. I mean, nobody wants to be part of a conversation where they're either held up as the race baiter or held up as the racist. Like, who wants to join that conversation? Nobody does. So I have found that people are very interested in the conversation about race, as long as they feel like they can dig into it in a way that is exploratory and not, you know, being pointing out people's differences and challenging people on having their opinions. I don't know that there's some sort of right answer you have to get to in these conversations.
Mm-hmm. Are the people who watch your Black in America series on CNN or who come to and take part in these Black in America town hall meetings
very diverse?
I was going to ask, are they the ones who would benefit most from the conversation, or are they already predisposed to be open to the other side because they're there or they're watching, they're interested already?
You know, I don't know that we poll people that way. I think people who, we know certainly from tracking our Black in America series that it was a very diverse audience, that there was this theory that, well, only black people will watch something called Black in America, but actually it was very diverse, and that there was a large number of black people watching Latino in America, which I found fascinating, and to me it said what I had always thought. So people are very interested in authentic stories about maybe people they don't know or want to understand better. And if you can stick to being authentic and stick to really telling real stories without either sugarcoating it or villainizing people, that people will watch.
But I guess what I was trying to get at with the question is that I would think
are they in the tent already?
Yeah.
Are you You know, I don't know the answer. I don't know. My experience has been that people who want to take part in a conversation. I mean, some of the conversations we've had have been tough, you know, I mean, awkward. And I always think people are very brave when they say, well, this is how I feel. And maybe it's not politic, but this is how I'm feeling. I feel that something is being taken away from me. I think that's a really brave thing to say in front of an audience of people. And then other people who say, you know, I'm a young black male on campus, and I just feel like I absolutely cannot get a leg in on anything here. You know, I'm stopped by the police. I'm humiliated all the time. Do you know what it's like to go through life like that? And so I think that those people, I don't know that they're constantly preaching to any choir. I think that they want to be heard in their personal experience. And if you can allow, you know, that to be exposed to people, that there's only good in that.
How did you do it? Because, you know, you were raised to think of yourself as black. You have, what, 7 other siblings or 8 other siblings?
5 other siblings.
5 other.
But at some point, it's
just
a lot.
It was a big family. But, and every single one of you, every single, this is astounding, all of you went to Harvard. All of you have turned out really, really well. How did you do that? I mean, if you're at a disadvantage being black in America, which you are, how did you overcome?
Well, you know, I think it's much more complicated than that, right? I don't think there's some kind of linear line here. I think that socioeconomics plays a big role, opportunity to education. I went to a perfectly good public school, certainly nothing like the kinds of public schools that some of the kids in my stories have gone to. I was in an intact family, two-parent family. We know the research on a two-parent family shows benefits for the kids and the parents and financial benefits. So I think that there's, you know, it's never sort of this one idea that makes someone successful or not successful, as you know. It's always this multifactorial thing. My parents were educators, so they had this huge value of education that a lot of my friends who were white friends didn't have because their parents didn't, you know, didn't work in education and didn't really know how to navigate the educational system for them. And certainly everybody knows, I know people who are black and successful and black and struggling and white and successful and white and struggling. And what was interesting, and we'll talk a little bit about it in Charlotte tonight, is this, you know, idea of how at the same time you see these gaps in white-black, you also start to see these gaps in, you know, have and have not. That socioeconomic gap has just been growing.
I was going to ask if these conversations have gone from being strictly about race, black versus white, white versus black, or into poor versus rich, educated versus uneducated,
always.
Access
and
to health care or not.
Strictly, yeah, they've never strictly been black versus white, right? There's always been this correlation, but certainly you can never just say it's black versus white. It's all of those things. You know, access and opportunity are the things that I think define America. You know, the American dream is a dream that goes across all socioeconomic boundaries and all racial boundaries, but it's certainly become much more challenging when you look at the data from the 1970s forward. And so I think that's also set a little bit of a tone. I think people, white people and black people, are frustrated and challenged, and I think that's playing out in what we see today. You know, we certainly played out in why Bill de Blasio was elected mayor of New York City when you look at the people polled. Not poor people, not, you know, overwhelmingly people of color, but middle-class New Yorkers said they are afraid of income inequality. Middle-class, because, you know, I think it was the Governor Cuomo, who said, you know, middle-class in New York City is now, you better earn $300,000 or more. $300,000 to be middle-class. You know, so things are changing, and that's scaring people.
Yeah.
And so I don't think you have ever been able to do a story about race that wasn't also about class. And as you well know, you know, the March on Washington was not just about opportunity for black people. It was about economic justice for poor and working class people.
Soledad O'Brien began her conversations on race on CNN. They continue on that network, and she brings the show on the road tonight to the Knight Theater, her Black in America Town Hall, sponsored by the Harvey B. Gantt Center for African American Arts and Culture. It's at 7 o'clock. Information on that's on our website at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talk. Soledad O'Brien, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. Steve Crump is a longtime TV journalist here in Charlotte. His work has figured prominently on WBTV News, but Steve is also a documentarian, and this month marks the release and broadcast of a 4-part documentary series on key events in the civil rights movement that occurred in 1963. Two an episode on Medgar Evers, and one on the March on Washington have already aired on WTVI PBS Charlotte, but the next two will air this week and next, and Steve joins us for the remainder of the hour to talk about his latest work. Good morning. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Nice to have you with us. There are, as I said, four documentaries in this series. The Medgar Evers and the March on Washington have already aired. Coming up this week is an episode entitled Sunday Morning Martyrs, and then in the final week of February, an episode called Justice Delayed and Promises Delivered. All of these center around events that occurred in 1963. Why that year?
Well, truth be told, I just saw the final audio mix of Sunday Morning Martyrs 10 minutes ago on the way here.
Oh, right to the wire, baby. There's Thursday
Well, you and I work together at Channel 3, and you know how it is. It's just like some days the paint just isn't quite dry before it hits the air.
Well, if you work in news, you're not done until seconds before
it hits the air. It's like that scene from Broadcast News where they're running the tape down the hallway. But, Mike, I'm going to tell you, you know, you look at that particular summer of 63 and roughly a period of 100 days where you end up starting going back, and there will be flashbacks in this particular series or even in the Sunday Morning Martyrs piece, where on June 10th or June 11th of 63 you had the University of Alabama being integrated when federal troops came in and made George Wallace, the then governor, step aside. And that happened on June 11th. That night you had President Kennedy giving his address on civil rights, one of the first that he did. Mm-hmm. And then later that evening you had the assassination of Medgar Evers, which all kind of happened, you know, fast and furious in terms of a flurry of events. Several weeks later, the March on Washington occurs, and then 18 days after that, the bombing in Birmingham. So this past summer, there were all of these commemorative events, and so I figured, okay, we can stitch together a nice piece. But the reality is, after going to Jackson, Mississippi a couple of times and covering some of the events relating to Medgar Evers, and you know this having been a television producer yourself, it's like, gosh, I cannot squeeze this into 18 minutes, you know, 18 minutes in an hour on Medgar Evers. So we ended up saying, let's just do 4:30s, and that's kind of what's happened here.
When you look back, because, you know, when things are happening, as a reporter on day-to-day news, when things are happening, you don't see the connections. And sometimes things look like coincidence when, in fact, they're not. When you look back on those events, those four events in 1963, were they coincidental or was one building upon another? Did the March on Washington, for instance, trigger that bombing in Birmingham because that march scared people, white people, into doing that? Did the Medgar Evers death result from something that came before because of his support for Emmett Till? Did all these things build upon each other?
I think they did. I mean, when you look at the whole scenario as it relates to what was happening in Alabama and in Mississippi, and I'll come back to what was going on here in North Carolina, because we had a lot of those things already resolved, such as sit-in type, you know, integration that occurred at lunch counters and that. But the reality is, in, you know, June of 63, you've already integrated the University of Mississippi. Locally in Birmingham, they were going through school integration at that time. So, yeah, there was some angst and some revolt that came out.
Yeah. It's amazing to me that they were integrating the schools in Birmingham in 1963, and we were still talking about integrating the schools here in 1970.
And I was kind of surprised when I saw that as I was going through some of the old headlines in Birmingham in the newspaper archives. They were talking about local school integration in 63, and that was quite obviously 9 years after Brown v. Board occurred. But there were a lot of emotions that were frankly on edge there.
You've done a number of other documentaries on civil rights over the years, one about the Tuskegee Airmen, the slave trade, the history of black jockeys, one called Lessons from the Lunch Counter, about another about Dorothy Counts, who in 1957 began to – she was the pioneer of integration in the Charlotte schools. How much have you personally – because you lived through much of this period, but going back and doing these documentaries, how much have you personally learned about that period of time?
Well, I think in a lot of ways, and this is one of the gifts about being in Charlotte, and you talk about Lessons from the Lunch Counter, and we lost a giant in this community a few weeks ago when Franklin McCain passed away, who was in last week's episode where he basically said, The reality is what they did in Greensboro on February 1st of 1960, they were pretty much validated by what occurred at the March on Washington. So it's always an interesting experience where you just have so many people in this community that have done so many wonderful things. And I think as a journalist, I stand on the shoulders of people like a Dorothy Counts or a Julius Chambers or a Charles Jones or a Franklin McCain and the people who pretty much laid the groundwork for people and, such as myself and a Soledad O'Brien.
But as you do the research that's necessary to interview these people, and then as you sit down and talk to these people, who many of whom are legends and pioneers in the civil rights movement, and who have stories to tell that perhaps they haven't told before or you haven't heard before, what's coming into your head? How have you grown as a person? How does this inform, as you've done many documentaries on civil rights, how has this informed the next documentary that you do?
I think it allows you to remain open. I mean, what I find amazing, and just a block down the street from our studios, Mike, is you have the Carolina Room in the library, and you go up to the third floor, and you unearth a lot of hidden treasures. There's a part of you that goes through the, gee, I didn't know this, to, okay, I understand why some things were the way that they were. Also, in as much as, here's how some things perhaps affect you personally. Keep in mind for me, within a week of the March on Washington, I'm starting first grade at an integrated Catholic school in my hometown of Louisville, Kentucky.
You're such a baby. Go ahead.
At least you're not on the weather desk tonight and I'm calling you Father Time,
That's right. I'm not as gray yet as Eric.
or Mike McKay.
That's right. Since two of these have already aired, will they be available for people to see online? Are they?
Yeah, we're recycling. It's one of those things that where people say all the time. It's just like, oh, I saw so and so on. So you never know when they're going to repeat. I mean, obviously February is going to be the first run, mm-hmm. and they will be back again. And we hope to make them available in the local libraries and CMS as well.
So let's go through the series. Episode one was called Medgar Evers: Reflections and Rededication. He was assassinated in 1963. Put him into context for people who were not alive back then.
Medgar Evers was the Mississippi field representative for the NAACP. And as you alluded to, he was one of those people that happened to be involved in the death of Emmett Till. He was involved in civil rights, voting rights, the kinds of, blatant brutality that happened with police departments.
And Emmett Till was a 14-year-old African-American boy who was shot for allegedly flirting with a white woman.
Whistling.
Okay.
Right. And allegedly is the key word there. And Evers was one of the people. It became a huge issue for the NAACP. And as the field director for the state of Mississippi, Evers would go into these communities and find out what would happen and send reports to Roy Wilkins and Thurgood Marshall and the people in New York.
And even if he did whistle at the white woman, this is, this reminds me very much of what just happened in Florida with the guy playing the loud music and Michael Dunn shooting at him and killing him. I mean, it's the same thing, isn't it?
50 years later.
We have to take a break. Stay. Steve Crump is our guest, a WBTV journalist and documentary producer. Black History Month project for WTVI, PBS Charlotte, airing right now. And we'll continue our conversation about that series of documentaries in just a second. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Area Transit System. Public transit benefits more than just commuters. It also connects the community to education, sporting, and cultural venues and creates jobs through private development. Details at ridetransit.org. And Nexen Pruitt hosting a breakfast briefing on smartphones at work. Smart idea in Charlotte tomorrow at 7:30 a.m. Details online at nexenpruitt.com. A white Florida man was convicted of attempted murder for firing a gun at four African-American teenagers playing loud music. It's been in the news all over the place of late, and Diane Rehm and her guests talk about that controversy over the jury's verdict and stand your ground laws across America in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. And we continue our conversation on a related topic, race, and look back further on the race, on the civil rights movement activities of 1963 with Steve Crump when we come back.
It was a 1980 Ford Fiesta.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It used to belong to Bruce Willis's brother. It was a terrible car. The door would fall off, and you'd have to pick it up and put it back in the car and latch it. Oil would ooze out of the dashboard. It's amazing to think that even that car could become like a segment in All Things Considered or a Bluff the Listener game. Turn your car into the programs you love.
Donate your car through Car Talk's vehicle donation program.
Go to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest in this segment, Steve Crump, WBTV journalist and documentarian. His series on this, four of the key civil rights happenings of 1963 is airing on WTVI. The next one will air on Thursday night. It's called Sunday Morning Martyrs about, excuse me, not Sunday Morning Martyrs.
It is Sunday Morning Martyrs.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. But we're talking about Medgar Evers at the moment because we're starting with episode one. Evers was a civil rights activist trying to overturn segregation at the University of Mississippi, and he did support, as we said, Emmett Till. And did that make him any different than Martin Luther King's approach? Was his approach different from that of Dr. King?
One of the things that came out in the very first episode with Medgar Evers, and you'll see this one in the last one, more so we focus on Injustice Delayed and Promises Delivered, Medgar Evers was a marked man from the get-go. And there is a journalist who is one of my heroes. He's a writer with the Clarion Ledger newspaper. His name is Jerry Mitchell. Jerry Mitchell is fearless. And the reason why I say that is he ended up unearthing a series of documents that you can now find online, the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission. This was a state-supported commission that pretty much, you know, even though they were under the arm of the state of Mississippi, they also provided a means far as the defense for Byron D. LeBeckwith, the guy who was ultimately convicted of killing Medgar Evers. And, you know, the thing that Mitchell unearths is they had all kinds of background information on not just Evers, but so many other people. I mean, they kept files all the way down to his home phone number so people could call and make harassing phone calls, even to the license tag of his 1955 Oldsmobile, you know. And it was he was just a marked man from the very beginning.
And he knew it. Merle yes. Evers Williams, his widow, appeared at a screening of your documentary in January for that episode and said that her husband believed he was going to be killed because of his activism. Obviously, there was ever-present danger for all of these civil rights leaders. Do you understand, after having done all these documentaries, do you understand that kind of courage?
I think courage is the operative word there, simply because when you look at not just what was happening in Alabama and Mississippi, but even in as much as the students from North Carolina A&T and Johnson C. Smith University, the fact that not just the whole courage of ending up in jail where parents could lose jobs if their kids were involved in the civil rights movement. You know, I mean, those kinds of things. I think that's the question as it relates to this generation. Who has the courage to stand? Who has the courage to step up? You know, who would be willing to risk everything like, you know, these people that are dying off, you know, did back in the day? I mean, it's like it's one thing now to be able to go in and sit down at a lunch counter. But, you know, the reality is you have a lot of incidents that have occurred. And you just pointed to the episode in Florida that happened with the court and the jury a few days ago.
Yeah. Episode two of the series, which has also already aired, it was called Moments of the March Then and Now, about the March on Washington. As you said, you weren't even in the first grade when the March on Washington
occurred. A week
away. In 1963. So what do you remember about that event? What were your parents and other adults in your life saying about that event that you remember?
You know, you living, growing up in D.C., all right, and I
remember it.
Oh, I'm sure you do.
And, I was older than you. I still am, by the way. I'm still older than you.
And much wiser, Mr. Collins.
Yeah.
But let me just paint the landscape for you, because this is what was happening in Louisville, where I grew up, just like D.C., where you were growing up. You probably remember the Afro-American newspaper, which was a weekly newspaper. We had something back home called the Louisville Defender, you know, and you probably remember a lot of the R&B stations in D.C., and long before there was ever a Donnie Simpson. But, you know, even in as much as back home, there was a daytimer. It was WLOU radio. So, you know, so my family was exposed to that kind of, you know, they would call the newspaper, well, what's in the Black Dispatch this week? They would call it the Black Dispatch. And so there was a level of sensitivity that was always there, you know, and there were folks in my neighborhood that were union activists that went to these kinds of marches. You know, you would find churches that would organize buses. And even in a lot of instances, you know, we had rioting there. So, you know, it was always in front of you. And mm-hmm. I think the question is, how did you respond to it?
You interviewed, as you said, Franklin McCain of the Greensboro Four for that. I think it was his last. His last interview.
Yeah.
What did he have to say?
You know, it's kind of interesting. I got to spend New Year's Day with Franklin at the hospital in Greensboro, and I remember the night that we had dinner at his home over off Reams Road. And we talked about this march leading up to the 50th anniversary. And, you know, he said that there was a fever that was running in this country then. Mm-hmm. And you go back to what you said earlier in terms of just the whole level of events where one came after the other and after the other. And covering Franklin McCain's funeral, Reverend Jesse Jackson was there. And he made the point, you know, he said, look, had there not been a Franklin McCain, there may not have been a march on Washington.
Wow.
And it's just one of those things of where, you know, when you talk to Franklin McCain, he understands what they did, but he was also wise enough to get the big picture.
Was that march the turning point in the civil rights movement, or was it events like Selma, in which news, very primitive to by our standards today, but news coverage of those policemen turning fire hoses on rioters and attack dogs on them. Which was the more important event?
I think it was the continuum, you know, because I remember, you know, the last time I was on your show was I was in Washington when you had the roundtable in the studio mm-hmm. with Charles Jones and Jack Claiborne, I believe,
right.
You know, and some of the other folks involved in the March on Washington. And the point that Jack Claiborne makes, and you'll see him again in the Justice Delayed Promises Delivered, what occurred in 1963 set the stage for the Civil Rights of 64. And even in as much as Selma, that was March 8th, 1965, and within 6 months you had a voting rights bill. Within a year of the March on Washington, you had a civil rights bill. You know, so to answer your question, Mike, I think that those kinds of events, those kinds of sacrifices put the legislation in motion.
So on Thursday night, a show that has not yet aired, which you can actually see, does air on WTVI, mm-hmm. Sunday Morning Martyrs. This centers around, kind of uses a starting point, the story of the little girls who died in the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in Birmingham. But it centers around what happened there 50 years later, which was a community gathering for forgiveness, which is striking to me.
You look at what occurred in that city, and what was surprising to me, and you know, you talk about the plot line, and even one of the sound bites, there was a roundtable discussion that was sponsored by Regions Bank, and you had federal judges and congresspeople and Jane King from the early show on CBS moderating the conversation, and sitting next to her was Condoleezza Rice. And in the process of that discussion was somebody who was a speaker on that program that day by the name of Anthony Fox.
Really? Now, the
who you will see, by the way.
The Medgar Evers murder happened just before the March on Washington. And right after the March on Washington comes the bombing of this church in Birmingham where these four little girls were killed. Did that help? I mean, despite the tragedy of this, did that help this movement move forward? I mean, that seems to me, in retrospect, and I was a young kid then, must have been horrific for people to hear about.
I think that you kind of set it in motion, like when you talked about, you know, the fire hoses in Selma, Alabama, where you kind of see that level of brutality. You know, television news was defining itself then. Mm-hmm. You know, that was when probably more than half the television sets in the country were black and white. Mm-hmm. You know, you didn't have live shots and satellite trucks or Twitter or Facebook, you know, and people were, you know, getting, you know, the information out in dribbles at the time. But I think the heinousness of that, and Fox, the soundbite, the one soundbite that he we used in that piece from him, he says, you know, regardless of who you are and what was going on, we all became the same on that day, on that Sunday, and that was we all became parents. And I think regardless of what your slant in life may have been, you know, regarding, civil rights, the reality is these were innocent victims. Mm-hmm. These were little girls and ranged in age from 8 to 14.
Yeah. The final episode will air on February 27th called Justice Delayed and Promises Delivered, which is a kind of a double-edged sword, really, because it took so long to get the justice, but it finally came through. This is about conviction in the church bombing that came 30 years after the fact. Why did it take so long after the passage of the Civil Rights Act for these killers to be brought to justice?
Well, not just the Birmingham bombing. We also look at the Byron D. LeBeckwith trial. And I think that it was just perseverance on the part of so many people, where you have such a heroine like Merle Evers, and the fact that she was able to come to Charlotte and just spill her guts out to a room full of folks at the Gantt Center. We were supposed to have done it at the Mint, snowed out. The folks at the Gantt said, hey, move it across the street in 5 hours. We made it work. I'm very grateful. But, you know, Merle Evers talks about the fact that one of the promises that she made to her husband is she was going to raise the kids. And if anything ever happened to him, mm-hmm. she would seek justice. And that came. It didn't happen easy or overnight, but it came.
And she said that in the aftermath of, you know, her husband was killed on the front porch of their house. The kids were inside the house. She was inside the house. And she said that for years after that, she was
angry.
Angry. And she was angry at every white person that she saw. And justifiably so. Did the justice that came to these people, was it the right kind of justice? What justice did they receive?
You know, what I find interesting, and you'll see this in the show, is in Jackson, Mississippi, there is a mixed bag. There are people that feel as though, yes, it demonstrates the possible. If you believe in something long enough, if you have faith in something long enough, it will come to pass. But the other side of that is there are other people that thought it was, you know, anticlimactic. It was one of those things of where, look, when they convicted Byron D. LeBeckwith, he was 73 years old. And we had interviewed a biographer, a guy by the name of Dr. Michael Vincent Williams, who wrote a book on Medgar Evers. And he said, you know, Byron D. LeBeckwith had already lived his life. He had already had time to raise his grandchildren, you know, and the whole bit. So, you know, he dies while serving the sentence at age 80. And so in that regard, it didn't mean a lot to some of the people there. But to somebody like a Merle Evers or the journalist that I mentioned, Jerry Mitchell, who had been on this crusade, there was a certain level of vindication and demonstrates that justice can come.
Talk to me about how long the system that protected these people stayed in place. How difficult was it to crack the nut, so to speak, and figure out who did what, get enough evidence to take them to trial and then convict them?
Great question, Mike. And I'll use the Birmingham example. Doug Jones, who is a federal prosecutor, and he says on camera, you know, you had a scenario where memories were fading, witnesses were dead.
Mm-hmm.
Enter, again, Jerry Mitchell, who not only on the Evers case, he goes down to Texas and interviews a guy by the name of Bobby Frank Cherry, who was one of the three bombers that was convicted in the Birmingham case. And it was one of those things of today, you know, it would not have played as well. But when, you know, he was being interviewed in 63 about the bombing, when it happens, like, oh, I was at home with my wife watching wrestling on a Saturday night. Well, they went to the Birmingham TV listings from 1963. And what came on Saturday night? Like Jackie Gleason. There was no wrestling for like another year. So, you know, and he had signed affidavits and the whole bit. So that kind of began the tale to unravel.
As terrible as these events were, did they help to move the movement? And in their absence, would the movement have moved as quickly as it did? Because as you said, from 1963 through about 1965, a lot of dominoes fell.
Oh, it did. It did. You know, coming back to something that you said in Birmingham, and you look at this whole scenario in term, and I found it more so in Birmingham than Jackson, where it was a community celebration. They dedicated a monument to the girls called Four Spirits, and there was a fellow who is an attorney by the name of Chervis Isom, a prominent attorney in Birmingham, and there was a profile piece that I read on this guy. We don't get into it in the story that we tell, but he calls himself, quote, a reformed racist. Mm. And what I'm getting to is not just do you remember the girls, but I think in as much as Birmingham with the Bull Connors and the fire hoses and that, you know, they've pretty much have said, look at us now. We've made it through this.
Yeah. You have said that 1963 was a year of change in America unlike any other. How would you compare it to 1968? That's a year that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated quickly thereafter. People rioted in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention for the Vietnam War, against the Vietnam War. Richard Nixon was elected president. How do you compare 63 to 68?
I think you have to, in the aggregate, you know, when you it was a roller coaster. But when you look at civil rights, again, you had the death of innocent people. You know, you had laws that were being changed. There was a civil rights bill of 63 that didn't quite make it out, you know. So in that regard, I think – and you have the assassination in 63 of John F. Kennedy.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, that has theoretically nothing to do with the civil rights movement, but it happened in the Deep South. It happened in Dallas. Could it have?
You know, there are so many theorists on that particular episode, but – you know, I think the reality is when you look at the continuum of where Kennedy was and that he did take stands on civil rights.
Right. Steve Crump, WBTV journalist and documentarian, his series of four Black History Month. How do I put this? What do we call the series?
It's not a trilogy, so what's the word after trilogy?
I don't know. There's four of them.
Four of them, yeah.
And the last two episodes air this Thursday and next Thursday night on WTVI PBS Charlotte. Sunday Morning Martyrs airs on Thursday evening, and Justice Delayed and Promises Delivered airs next Thursday, February 27th. Steve Crump, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Appreciate it.